Okay, thank you very much, Sister Sakina Taqawi, for the points. So we talked about the 13-year-old girl who was dominant over her siblings and she was being aggressive. And so you gave us a few points saying that the parents should not worry and they should give them space, not get annoyed with their behavior, and even teach them indirectly. The indirectly is very important, that we shouldn't start advising them directly because they're at an age where they don't like to be advised. And we should try and give them family time where we can talk about these things and instill values, and even give them alone time where we can be friends with them, and also give them responsibilities as well, which makes them feel grown up. And these are the very beautiful points that you gave. Inshallah, the sister, the mother of this child, can somehow sort her problem and solve it, inshallah. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for joining us on this program. And dear audience, if you have any questions, any comments, any suggestions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir, and visit us at our website, parstoday.com, and subscribe to our YouTube channel and Facebook page, Call of Islam Radio. And inshallah, till the next program, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Suratul Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
Qad aflahal mu'minun.
Certainly will the believers have succeeded.
الذين هم في صلاتهم خاشعون.
They who are during their prayer humbly submissive.
والذين هم عن اللغو معرضون.
And they who turn away from ill speech.
Brothers and sisters, we were giving you some kind of general view on the contents of this surah before we get into details and talk about the different verses of this chapter. We mentioned that the contents of this surah are mostly about the special attributes of the believers. In the first part, continuing for several verses, this surah mentions some of the attributes that lead to the salvation of the believers. In the second part, the verses mention the different signs of knowing Allah that can be found in the world of existence, both in microcosm and macrocosm. In the third part, to complete the practical dimensions of the noble surah, the verses cite the instructive biography of some of the great prophets such as Noah, Hud, Prophet Musa, and Jesus, peace be upon him, as a few examples by mentioning certain aspects of their lives. And then, in the fourth part, the chapter addresses the arrogant, sometimes by appealing to their logical reason, and sometimes by warning them in harsh tones, in order to arouse the consciousness of the receptive ones and find their way back to Allah. And then, next to that, the verses contain some concise discussions on the subject of resurrection. And in the sixth part, the verses talk about both Allah's sovereignty over the world of existence and irresistibility of His command over the entire universe. And then, when we reach the ending verses of this surah, the resurrection, the weighing of deeds, the reward for those who do right and the punishment for those who do wrong are again mentioned. And the noble surah ends by mentioning the aim of the creation of man, which is a necessary point in knowing the program of life and how to achieve salvation and deliverance. So, the content of this surah is a collection of some cognitive issues that encourages us to reflect and the doctrinal and practical lessons, and from the beginning of the surah to the end, talk about the entire path that the believers must pave. We mentioned that this surah was revealed in Mecca, yet some commentators of the Holy Quran have said that some of its verses had been revealed in Medina, and this is because it contains a verse that refers to the almsgiving or zakat.
تألقا وأضاء لي الدنيا طريقا. We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter
الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
Since paying zakat was first legislated in Medina, this fact has led them to think that the complete surah could not have been revealed in Mecca, because it is known that zakat was at first legislated in Medina after the revelation of the verse خُدْ مِنْ أَمْوَالِهِمْ صَدَقَةً, which is mentioned in the 103rd verse of chapter Tawbah, take out of their possessions alms. So by this verse, the Prophet ﷺ ordered the tax collectors and alms collectors to go around and collect this tax from the people. And with respect to this issue, we must be aware, however, that the zakat also has a general meaning that includes both obligatory and recommended zakat. So its meaning is not limited to the obligatory sadaqah or zakat alone, because we can see in the Islamic narrations that the ritual prayer and the payment of this tax has often been mentioned together. A narration from Imam Sadiq and Imam Baghir alayhim as-salam says, Allah has made the alms tax along with the ritual prayer obligatory. So some Islamic scholars believe that the alms tax had also been obligatory in Mecca, but it was general and somehow undefined. It means that everyone was obliged to give some part of his possessions to the needy. But when the Islamic government was established in Medina, a precise system was devised for regulating and collecting, and after that distributing this zakat, along with specifying the minimum value of property upon which it should be collected by the Prophet's agents. So we still believe that the contents and the verses of this surah were all revealed in Mecca. Thank you for staying with us, dear listeners. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Joe Biden's first military action as President of the United States was to bomb Syria, cementing himself as another warmonger in the Oval Office. The claim that these strikes were defensive in nature is an absurdity coming from an occupying force, which most seem to gloss over. This was a violation of Syria's sovereignty and territory and another act of imperialist aggression. So let's break this down. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. On February 25th, 2021, the United States bombed the Syrian Arab Republic. The airstrikes took place on the border between Iraq and Syria, around Abu Kamal, located in the Deir ez-Zor province in eastern Syria. According to the Syrian Arab News Agency, four were wounded and one person was martyred. Shortly after the attack, the Pentagon released a statement saying, quote, at President Biden's direction, U.S. military forces earlier this evening conducted airstrikes against infrastructure utilized by Iranian-backed militant groups in eastern Syria. These strikes were authorized in response to recent attacks against American and coalition personnel in Iraq and to ongoing threats to those personnel. Specifically, the strikes destroy multiple facilities located at a border control point used by a number of Iranian-backed militant groups, unquote. So this statement claims that these strikes were defensive, which is an absurdity in of itself. Syria has not bombed the United States or declared war on the United States. Syria is on the other side of the planet. The United States has no business being in Syria. Moreover, the claim that they were meant for de-escalation simply does not compute. Bombing another country is tantamount to a declaration of war, not de-escalation. China, Venezuela, Iran all condemned the attack, and Russia's foreign ministry spokeswoman, Maria Zakharova, strongly condemned the bombing and called for unconditional respect for the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Syria, which should not be used to settle geopolitical scores. So according to the Biden administration, this attack on Syria was a response by the United States to recent attacks on its personnel. Now, it's widely assumed by the media that what they're referring to is a rocket attack that took place on February 15th in Erbil in Iraq, where an American contractor was killed. Six others were wounded, including an American soldier. And in another instance on February 22nd, when a rocket landed inside the Green Zone in Baghdad. This is where the U.S. Embassy is located, the biggest embassy in the world, almost the size of Vatican City, which looks more like a military installation than anything else. So while the United States claims it's defending itself and responding to rocket attacks, it conveniently leaves out the obvious that the United States is in Iraq illegally. It illegally invaded Iraq in 2003, along with Britain. The U.S.-led coalition has no right to be in Iraq in the first place, nor in Syria for that matter. So you can't talk about defending yourself when you are the aggressor, when you are the oppressor, when you are illegally on someone else's land. You're not defending yourself when you're on someone else's land, you are attacking. Moreover, the United States has imposed crippling sanctions on Iran, which are indeed a form of siege warfare. It assassinated General Soleimani. It has violated Iran's sovereignty numerous times. But the U.S. is not officially at war with Iran, so why is it bombing Iranian-backed militias? Is that supposed to make it okay? When the U.S. talks of Iranian-backed militias, what they really mean are the Popular Mobilization Forces, the PMU, or in Arabic, the Hashd al-Sha'bi. These are not Iranian troops. They're a popular resistance movement made up of various local ethnic religious groups, which include Shia, Sunni, Christians, Druze, but fought very hard to defeat Daesh and to resist occupation. But of course, the United States can't speak of them as a popular resistance because then people would rightfully wonder, what are they resisting? And this would expose the United States and their allies as illegal occupiers, as an invading force, which has no right to be there in the first place. As long as a Pentagon official or a stenographer for the White House says Iran or Iranian-backed militias, that's all it takes for everyone's brains to suddenly shut down and just accept that Joe Biden is bombing another sovereign nation. First of all, whether Iran has troops or militias, as they say in Syria, or the other way around, this is a matter between Iran and Syria. The United States has no right to interfere in the eternal politics, alliances, partnerships, and cooperations between those two countries. Would the United States accept it if, for example, Syria bombed Korea for having an American base there? Of course not. So this is not a valid argument. Syria is a sovereign nation, Iran is a sovereign nation, Iraq is a sovereign nation. But of course, this is of no concern to the Americans and British who have colonized the region for centuries, plundering and stealing resources and meddling in the region's political affairs. Donald Trump assassinated General Qasem Soleimani, the head of Iran's Quds force, along with Abu Mahdi, a senior commander of the Hashd al-Sha'bi, the PMU. Now, Joe Biden bombs the PMU inside Syria. Both these actions only serve to help Daesh. And this wouldn't be the first time, of course, that the United States and its military actions, whether purposely or not, end up helping Daesh seeking to take over Syria and Iraq. In 2016, U.S. warplanes killed 62 Syrian troops in an airstrike and wounded more than 100. These troops were directly involved in the fight against Daesh. Again, in 2018, the U.S. bombed Syrian and Russian troops inside Syria, which only serves to help the foreign-backed terrorists, which they were fighting in the first place. But on top of that, they're not only benefiting Daesh with these actions, Israel is at the very least very sure to be happy about Biden's decision to bomb Syria. After all, for years Israel has been routinely bombing Syria almost on a weekly basis, taking advantage of the fact that Syria is crippled by war and sanctions. And usually Israel almost never admits to the illegal assassinations or bombings that it carries out on other nations and governments, but Israeli officials have previously confirmed that they have carried out hundreds, if not over 1,000 airstrikes on Syria in the last decade alone. And seeing how close Israel and the United States are in their shared interests, it's not surprising, of course, that Joe Biden uses the exact same pretext. Joining me now to talk more about Biden's airstrikes on Syria is Max Abrams, Associate Professor of Political Science at Northeastern University and fellow at the Quincy Institute. Thanks for taking the time, Professor. Appreciate having you on.
Happy to be on your show.
So, Professor, in 2018, Donald Trump bombed Syria over the alleged chemical gas attacks in Douma. Now, the OPCW scandal, that's an entire story in of itself, but I want to focus on the contrast in reaction here. At the time, Democrats like AOC and Kamala Harris rebuked Trump, citing the illegality of the strikes, yet now they're mostly silent on Biden. So there's a bit of a double standard going on here in the reaction from the media and Democrats. Would you agree with that assessment?
I see what you're saying, and I could definitely go that route. I have seen what you're describing, which is apparent hypocrisy by Kamala Harris talking about illegality, Syrian sovereignty, and now she's the vice president, and there's doesn't seem to be any respect for Syrian sovereignty. That said, I see more continuity than differences, because although Trump, was very reviled in the American public, especially in the media, one of the very few things he ever did in his whole life that was celebrated in the aggregate was attacking Syria. You'll remember that Fareed Zakaria said after he authorized the strike, congratulations, Donald Trump, it's like your first day as president. You've finally become a real president. And so if you want to be popular, regardless of whether you're on the American political left or right, with the exception of the fringes, but sort of mainstream left, mainstream right, yeah, attack Iran, attack Syria, people will quibble, but in general, there is political value for that decision making.
Speaking of continuity, Donald Trump assassinated General Qasem Soleimani, the head of the Quds Force, and Abu Mahdi, senior commander in the PMU, which were hit just now in the airstrike by Biden. Would you say there's continuity in that and their general policy towards Iran? And who stands to benefit the most here exactly? Because, whether the United States calls them Iranian-backed militias or not, the PMU have still contributed enormously in the fight against Daesh, against ISIS. So who's benefiting the most from what just took place exactly?
You're quite right that when Trump authorized the killing of Soleimani, that was depicted as controversial in the United States, and he was criticized by Democrats, whereas clearly under Biden, we are seeing a continuity of targeted killing. And so there is hypocrisy there. With respect to who benefits, I think that one of the beneficiaries is Israel. I think that Israel, its greatest threat, according to Israeli officials, is this, it's described as a land bridge from Tehran to Beirut, particularly this axis, the Iranian government and the Iranian militia groups, all the way into the Levant. So I think that Israel recognizes that the Biden administration is not as categorically, reflexively pro-Israel as the Biden administration was. Now, don't get me wrong. I still expect the Biden administration to be very pro-Israel, but not to the same degree as Trump was. You know, they name towns and things after Trump. I'm not sure they're going to do that with Biden. So a lot of people, the conventional wisdom in the American media was that Biden was sending a signal to Iran. I actually think that the signal was to Israel more, saying we're not going to tolerate this kind of land bridge. And even though there was this delay from Biden contacting Netanyahu, don't worry, the Biden administration is going to look out for Israel just as Trump did. I think that probably the attack doesn't really surprise Iran all that much and probably doesn't fundamentally affect U.S.-Iranian relations. I think that it's not a significant... In the history books, this will not be registered as an event in terms of that important bilateral relationship. I do think that the media has done a very bad job, an intentionally bad job, in describing the relationship between Iran and ISIS. The American media likes to downplay the fact that Iran has been not only at odds with ISIS, but one of ISIS's primary enemies, especially on the ground. And that was true both in Iraq as well as in Syria. There's an inverse relationship between them and ISIS. And so there is a concern that if Iran were continued to be attrited, as well as Russia, which has also been deeply maligned, of course, in the American media in all sorts of ways, but especially with respect to its relationship to Salafi jihadists, that could create the kind of space for ISIS and al-Qaeda and affiliated jihadists to grow.
Yeah, indeed. And, you know, one thing I'm not seeing talked a lot about in the media is how this is going to affect the Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOA. What do you think will happen there, specifically when the Biden administration says they're open to more talks with European partners, although Iran says it wants sanctions lifted first? Do you think these strikes are going to affect the Iran nuclear deal and diplomatic endeavors in any way?
As you and your guests very well know, under Biden, the Obama administration really helped to broker the Iran nuclear deal. And so when Trump effectively destroyed it, and then Biden would get elected, one would think that, particularly because the nuclear deal was cast as Obama and Biden's one of their biggest, most important foreign policy legacies, you would expect them to just continue forward and to do whatever it takes to jumpstart this deal, which they were highly critical of Trump for derailing. But they haven't done that, actually. You know, they've added all these additional hoops. Who's going to go first? You know, is there going to be relief? You know, is the nuclear deal going to be fundamentally changed? Are they going to add provisions to it? Are they going to include more features, like with respect to rockets and support for militant groups? All of this kind of talk increases the odds that the nuclear deal will not be recommenced. And so it is a little bit surprising how tepid they are in pushing this negotiation forward. So there seems to be a lack of clarity and a lack of bravery from this administration. And I think that we see that in the Iran nuclear deal.
How about Democrats actually doing anything to limit the scope of the AUMF? Do you see anything happening there? You know, supposedly since they control the House and the Senate barely. I kind of already know the answer, but go ahead.
It'll be interesting to see how much this administration can moderate sort of its inclination, which is to get increasingly involved in the region at a time when the American public is turning away. I think that the administration is simply going to reframe and recast some of the same behaviors, but in different terms. So we see a continuation of the use of American military force and intervention, but there's a real emphasis by the Biden team to say that it's defensive in nature. We've seen this with the weapons going to Yemen. They are defensive. You know, we see the U.S. Attacking supposedly Iranian targets on the Syrian border, and it's defensive. So I think that there's a real sort of PR effort to present the United States as good guys, even if the U.S. will continue to liberally use military force, including probably to promote its freedom agenda, which it knows has taken on a negative connotation. And so perhaps that won't be as much of an emphasis as, for example, under the George W. Bush administration, when neoconservatives would just exclaim very loudly that our goal is to promote democracy throughout the region.
Max Abrams, thanks so much for your valuable insight. It's really a pleasure speaking with you and having you on the show. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to come on anytime.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
At the end of the day, we really get to see once again how Biden and his policies are just a continuation of the same old. As a matter of fact, they're almost indistinguishable from those of his predecessor, Donald Trump. Donald Trump puts sanctions on Syria, Biden keeps them. Donald Trump steals Syria's oil, Biden also steals Syria's oil. Trump builds illegal bases in Syria, Biden keeps them and builds more illegal bases in Syria. Trump bombs Syria in 2018, Biden also bombs Syria in 2021. That's not the lesser of two evils, that's precisely the same evil continued. When Trump imposed the Caesar Act sanctions on Syria in June 2020, we all knew that civilians would be hurt the most, that people would starve in a country already ravaged by a decade of war. Joe Biden, who people call the lesser of two evils, was he going to reverse this? Of course not. Secretary of State Blinken, who's his foreign policy advisor at the time during the campaign, told the Washington Post that Biden thought the sanctions were a very important tool. These sanctions have crushed the lira, the Syrian pound. Syrians are forming bread lines in a country that once used to be self-sufficient and a net exporter of wheat. Within days of Biden taking office, we saw a convoy of U.S. trucks illegally cross over from Iraq into Syria through the El Walid border crossing, as they always do, on their way to steal more oil. The Syrian permanent representative to the United Nations, Bashar al-Jafari, warned Joe Biden, quote, "The new U.S. administration must stop acts of aggression and occupation, plundering the wealth of my country, withdraw its occupying forces from it, and stop supporting separatist militias, illegal entities, and attempts to threaten Syria's sovereignty, unity, and territorial integrity." Of course, Joe Biden has done no such thing. And despite a statement by the Pentagon that their priority isn't the oil, Biden still has U.S. troops building bases in Syria illegally, occupying Syria's oil fields illegally. And just like Trump bombed Syria, now we see Biden bombing Syria, although not over chemical weapons, but another one of the media's favorite boogeymen, the so-called Iranian-backed militias. You know, at least in 2018, Kamala Harris, who's now the vice president, rebuked Trump, saying she's deeply concerned about the legal rationale of the strikes. Really? She's concerned about the legal rationale of such strikes? That's wonderful. I really hope she maintains that same attitude towards Joe Biden, although I highly doubt she will. Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez called Trump a mad king who decided to, quote, bomb a nation without the constitutional requirement of congressional approval. And yet, unlike 2018, suspiciously, AOC is nowhere to be found right now. She's been completely silent on Joe Biden's airstrikes on Syria. With the exception of Ilhan Omar, she correctly pointed out how outrageous the AUMF is. because of the sweeping powers that it gives the president. Fundamentally, you know, we still don't see any mention of actual consequences. Where's the plan to get rid of the AUMF? Where are the consequences for Joe Biden's actions in violating his oath of office and bombing a sovereign nation? We're not hearing any of it. They're all quiet. You know, I'm sure the American people are so happy to see that one of Joe Biden's first accomplishments in office has been to bomb Syria. Americans, the very same Americans who have yet to see any of those relief checks they were promised, which were originally $2,000, now reduced to $1,400. The same Americans who were told they can't have a minimum wage, a $15 minimum wage through budget reconciliation, even though Biden said it would be a top priority and made it one of the pillars of his campaign. The same Americans who were told no more kids in cages, which also turned out to be a lie. The kids are no longer separated from their parents, perhaps, but they're still locked up in nicer looking cages with air conditioners. The same Americans that were told the erratic Donald Trump would be defeated and replaced with Biden, who would restore the soul of the nation and dignity to the White House. It seems Americans were told a lot of things, a lot of nice things. And not just by Biden's campaign, but even by intellectuals and scholars that claimed he would be less dangerous than Trump. Well, as far as Syria is concerned, that's nonsense. But it's okay, though, because remember, at least now there's diversity. Remember, you were promised diversity and unity by the Biden administration? So now you have Lloyd Austin, the first black man to lead the Pentagon, who also happens to be a former board member for Raytheon, the weapons manufacturer. Or the fact that Kamala Harris is the first Asian American and female vice president. Or Avril Haines, the first woman to be director of national intelligence. Now that makes everything okay. Just put a bunch of rainbows on the bombs and everything will be okay, right? Of course, the neocons and proponents of the war on terror will tell you that Biden does have the right to do military strikes on other nations under the Authorization for the Use of Military Force, the AUMF. Which was signed into law in 2001, 2002, giving a carte blanche, a blank check for the Bush administration and every administration since to invade other countries, order drone strikes and assassinations and run wild with any foreign policy decision they please. Many have rightfully criticized the AUMF and have called it constitutional for the sweeping powers that it gives the commander-in-chief, who can effectively bypass Congress and go behind its back to attack other countries. But even if the entire U.S. Congress had okayed this imperialist attack on Syria, that would still not make it okay. The U.S. Congress is not the world police. Its decrees are not universal and absolute. Biden's airstrikes on Syria are first and foremost a violation of international law. The United States has no right to attack a sovereign nation and another member of the United Nations. This clearly violates the United Nations Charter, specifically Article 2.4, which says that all members shall refrain in their international relations from the threat or use of force against the territorial integrity or political independence of any state or in any other manner inconsistent with the purposes of the United Nations. But of course, it's not about laws, it's about language, it's about PR. So under Trump, the kids in cages, that's called concentration camps. But under Biden, they're migrant overflow facilities. And when Trump bombs Syria, they decry him as a mad king. But when Biden does, they're defensive airstrikes. You know, let's just go ahead and remove the word imperialism from the dictionary. Let's replace it with Biden's unity slogan instead, shall we? So while Biden's administration claims it's more diverse, let's be frank with each other here. There's no diversity in terms of policy. You know, he can paint as many transgender flags and put as many Black Lives Matter decals on the bombs as he wants. But these are the same imperialist tactics, the same imperialist agenda used by every president before him. This is just a furthering of America's imperialist interests and its neocon behavior, which the U.S. has been carrying out in the Middle East for the past decades, crippling Syria, crippling Syria's allies, being hawks on Iran, continuing to occupy Iraq illegally. That's what it comes down to, and there's no difference there. So to claim diversity, this means absolutely nothing for the people who are under those bombs when they fall. As a matter of fact, it means nothing for Americans, who are also being given the short end of the stick and robbed of their own wealth so that the military-industrial complex, the weapons manufacturers, and private corporations can make tons of money and build swimming pools for themselves while they starve. That's what it comes down to. There's no diversity there. But in moments like these, I think it's very important to look back at history, right? Damascus, the capital of Syria, where I was born, is the oldest continuously inhabited city in the world. It's thousands of years old. Many civilizations, many empires have tried to capture Syria. Many foreign invaders and their armies have tried to take the Middle East and claim Syria as their own. But none of them last forever. Look around Syria and you will find nothing but the ruins of those very empires who thought they would last forever. As history shows us, every dog has their day. Every empire rises and every empire falls. But Syria always remains, inshallah. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear brothers and sisters, you are listening to The Lantern, only here on IRIB English Radio. Thank you so very much for joining us again on this episode and sharing with us your precious time, lending us a listening ear. Life is a mess, without doubt, especially now that we've been through 2020, which really was a madhouse on steroids. 2020 was on crack in the sense of how many ups and downs it had, how many people we lost. The pandemic came out of nowhere. The world hadn't seen a pandemic to itself since World War. I mean, it's been almost 100 years. Speaking of pandemics, all the wildfires the world saw, the threat of a third world war, speaking of things that the world hadn't seen since World War I and II, the loss of great generals, pious men, great scientists, great athletes, great artists and actors and speakers and thinkers, separation from our loved ones, loss, all of that, so much. And I sometimes, when I was speaking to my friends in the previous year, and we would, you know, count all the crazy things that happened in 2020, we would sometimes think that maybe the world has always been this way, and we've just begun to notice it with 2020. It's been boldened and highlighted, maybe because of the pandemic, and we've all been stuck at home. Most of us, at least. I am not at home. I'm at the studio right now. But we're just picking things up more. And of course, it's the age of news and technology and connection and social media, so word gets around faster. I don't know what it is, but I personally feel that life has always been, this world at least, has always been a mess. Always. When was the last time you got a haircut, though? It must have been a long time ago, I think, because of the lockdown. Speaking of haircuts, let's listen to a short story about a blind barber. I'll be right back.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Salamun Alaikum. This is Lantern. And as usual, we have an interesting story entitled The Blind Barber. Benjamin was a popular barber. He was skilled and had many regular customers. During his work, he used to talk eloquently to entertain and enlighten his customers. One day, a godly man visited his saloon. While cutting the hair, the barber declared that he did not believe that God existed. The barber described the pain, poverty, and suffering that people had to endure everywhere. He argued that if there was a God who was loving and mighty, he should have removed such misery from society. After his hair was cut, the godly man came out of the barber shop. In the street, he saw a madman with long and dirty hair and ugly beard. He returned to the saloon and told the barber, "Now I am sure that there are no barbers in the street." "Why? Why do you say that?" he inquired emphatically. pointed to the madman, the godly man explained, "If there was a barber here, how could that man have such long and dirty hair and untrimmed ugly beard?" The barber defended his position. "I am the best barber in this city. There are several barbers in the other streets. That man is mad and does not come to any one of us to have a haircut. It's not our fault." The godly man replied, "That is quite true. Just like the barbers, God also exists. The problem is that people like you never search for him and refuse to meet him and seek his blessings. That is why you find so many in sorrow and suffering." The atheist could not argue further.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
When was the last time you saw a person you'd consider a true believer actively and consciously, intentionally break another person's heart, trample their rights, trample upon their rights, usurp something of theirs, lie to them, steal from them, betray them? Even yourself, if you consider yourself trying every day to move toward Allah and gaining His proximity, when you come to the realization that you really hurt someone's feelings, do you not feel sick to your stomach? Do you not feel like you wish, do you not wish that you could turn back time and take back those words and make it up to that person? Do you not beg Allah for forgiveness and wish you had never done that? And you try to compensate for that person? Or when we look at the infallibles, alayhim as-salam, or awliyaullah, people who really saw Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala with their hearts and looked forward to liqa'ullah in the hereafter, have they not done everything in their power to make the world a better place, to fight for justice, to stand up for the oppressed, to bring joy to the hearts of their fellow believers? Now, I'm not saying that every crime that has been committed throughout history was done by an atheist. A lot of people, but then again, the crimes that have been committed by those who claim to believe is because they only claim to believe, is because they haven't really seen Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Their hearts weren't filled with a sincere love and passion for truth and for finding God. They only claimed to know God. They only claimed to obey God. People hurt people. And if a person has the love for a merciful God in their heart and the admiration for a generous Ahlul Bayt, for the devotion toward a prophet which is known as the prophet of mercy, such a person will not find it within themselves to hurt other people and bring upon them pain. So the point is, if we have hardships and pain and difficulty in our lives, though it is the natural condition of the world, the fact that we are suffering from it, the fact that it is tearing us apart, the fact that it is bringing us down and hurting us so much, is because we have yet to see Allah. And just by saying that I believe in God doesn't necessarily mean that I have embraced God in my heart. And of course, there are many, many other reasons behind hardships and difficulties in life. They are sometimes a trial and a test. They are sometimes trials to test our iman. there are sometimes chastisement, means through which we are purged of our sins. And for the awliyaullah, people that we claim never hurt anyone, it couldn't even be karma, it is for their ranks in the hereafter to be elevated. But either way, the problem of pain is a philosophical, theological issue that should be assessed and analyzed thoroughly, and we need to come to a better understanding of it. And mostly, we need to understand that sometimes something that I might identify as pain really isn't pain at all. It's just because I'm not strong enough. I'm not in any way trying to undermine anyone's suffering. But chances are, if I fortify my iman and if I have a deeper connection with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, I'm going to get hurt way less in this world. Thank you for being with us on this episode of The Lantern. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
ألا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints and Analysis on the Thoughts and Works and Speeches of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. With me in the studio are two guest speakers, Brother Ali Alavian and Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the show.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah, thanks for inviting.
You're welcome. And Brother Ali Alavian, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum assalam, thank you for having me here.
Thank you very much, brother, for accepting my invitation. So it's really happy to have you both over here discussing some of the most important points which have been addressed by leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Since we are passing life in the blessed month of Rajab, Brother Mahmoud, the producer, dedicated this series to Imam Ali alayhi salam in the speeches of Ayatollah Khamenei. So there have been, we can say, some characteristics enumerated for Imam Ali alayhi salam in our previous discussion. You know, that Supreme Leader of Iran has pointed out in his speeches regarding the meritorious character of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Now, one of the things that a leader has clarified is this, we can say, anti-cruelty, anti-oppression personality of Imam Ali alayhi salam. So we know that, Brother Ali Alavian, let's start with you this episode. For 25 years, the absolute power and authority of Imam Ali alayhi salam was rejected at the early Islam. But still, it is documented that Imam Ali alayhi salam was against oppression, although he had not official power in his hands, but he was against oppression. Is it true?
Very true. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam Muhammad and his purified progeny. This is a very good topic to talk about, but before diving into this question, I think it's good to know for ourselves and then our brothers and sisters who are listening to us that when we are talking about Imam Ali alayhi salam and his anti-moral, anti-cruelty and oppression morale, it should not stay in the dawn of Islam, earlier centuries of the Islam, but it is still a live model for our today's life. So whatever we are talking about here actually is going to show us the way for our today's life to see how we can actually take some lessons and learn from this beautiful role model. Writers need to write, and speakers need to speak, and what has been written and what has been spoken actually cannot show a very even small part of what actually has been manifested and shown by and presented by Imam Ali alayhi salam. We have seen that Imam Ali alayhi salam actually faced oppression and cruelty in every aspect of it. From the time that he was with the Prophet, he faced those enemies of Islam, those who actually were oppressors against the Muslims and companions of the Prophet, whether in Mecca or Medina. And he was with the battle, he was with the front of Haqq, front of right and righthood. And he actually defended the righthood and defended the group of righteousness with his all actually power. We have seen that to whom he started actually fighting with at the time of the Prophet and at the time that he was also the leader of the Islamic Ummah. Look, the understanding of how to tackle oppression, it was very beautiful to be understood in behavior of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Look, in case this oppression was a personal thing, personal in the sense that actually it just affected his own life, he did not actually took it seriously. He did not take it seriously. Okay. In the sense that he wanted to see the oppression against, for example, others, humanity, Islamic values, and the new foundation which was going to set up.
That's right.
He could not tolerate these things.
Okay.
When his wife was martyred and he was actually oppressed by some, he actually did not have a reaction just to save Islam. But when he sees that, for example, a needy, the wealth of the people, the wealth of those, the wealth which should be actually distributed among the people as Baytul Mal is in the house of some companions or some, let's say, statesmen.
That's right.
He does not stay indifferent. He says whatever he needs to say. He does whatever he needs to do.
And the interesting point is that he was a man of action.
Mm.
He was a worker, you know.
Very true.
He was a laborer. He worked himself with his own hands. He earned his living with his own hands. You know, he had his own gardens. He has his own well of waters. He has his own palm gardens, you know. This is what made Imam Ali beautiful, because when the people looked at his sayings and said, do this and do that against the oppression, nowadays in the world is this, you know, there are so many leaders who are talking about anti-oppression thing, but when you look at their lives and behind the scene, they have the wealthiest life possible. But Ali, as a role model who was alive in front of the eyes of the people, had the life like the same as the people.
I think those aspects of his life as a good worker to earn his actually his livelihood is something else that we can, inshallah, discuss it later on. But I mean, the morale in front of oppression, and the way that he actually stood in front of oppression, in what kind of fronts or battlefields he stood, and he went, and with whom, with which figures, and personalities he is actually he was fighting. These are the things that actually are completely meaningful. When you see, for the sake of God, For your brother comes to you and asks you something which is not actually which is not his right, so you stand in front of him, you stand in front of him and tell him, no, this is where we need to get separated from each
other.
That's right. So he was fighting with those who had some name in Islam world at that time.
Okay.
For example, suppose those in our today's life, we see some people that are very famous to be the first graders of the, I don't know, first level Muslim authorities. Mm-hmm. But you need to stand in front of them.
That's right.
Because you are going to submissive to the will of Satan. And then, this Muslim authority, and you, as a Muslim, a duty-bound Muslim, need to stand in front of him and tell him that you're wrong.
That's right.
And if he does not accept, you go to fight him.
That's right.
So when I'm telling you that we need to take some lessons for our today's life, this is that Ali, we have to see Ali today.
Thank you very much, Brother Ali Alevian. And Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, I think this character of Imam Ali alayhi salam, this feature is a continuation of what Prophet Muhammad did at the early Islam. Prophet Muhammad saw the behavior